I'm going to be talking about this book, at least the human rights part of the book. And this is my very first Zoom presentation, so I feel very much like a beginner. As far as the relationship between international sport and human rights goes, it's clearly one that has been accelerating in recent years. And one way of charting that is I have set up a Google News alert so that every time an article in English appears with the word sport and human rights, I get a daily digest. And the number of those articles, they're articles every day, and the number is increasing. Just for example, about 2 weeks ago, there was a series of articles about the fact that a few human rights organizations have been calling on the IOC to take the Beijing 2022 Olympics away from Beijing on the grounds that China's human rights record is so poor. And that's just one of many examples of the way that a lot of groups in international sport and around international sport and pressure groups on international sport have been using the language of human rights to pressure international sport about the way its competitions are run. So there are new groups that have been formed around sport and human rights. For example, in 2018, the Center for Sport and Human Rights was set up. And there are lots of older groups like Human Rights Watch that are now spending significant amounts of time on sport. So Human Rights Watch devotes a lot of time to the Olympic Games, for example. And the IOC and FIFA have responded, especially in recent years, apparently committing themselves to this rhetoric of human rights. In March of this year, for example, the IOC committed to setting up a human rights unit and a human rights committee. Not sure what the difference is between those two, but more generally to adopting a comprehensive human rights strategy with the aim of embedding human rights in global sports governance, which of course is a very vague goal. The IOC included human rights provisions in the 2024 Paris contract, et cetera. We can see a lot of activity around this connection. So what I wanted to do today was to talk about the history of this connection and really to talk about why it's become important only very, very recently. And to try to explain why it's taken so long for this connection to really solidify. And at the end, I want to talk briefly about peace and human rights, peace and sport, peace being the longest running ideal associated with international sport. And then finally, I'll talk very briefly about the function that these ideals serve in the world of international sport. Why are these idealistic claims such an important part of international sport, especially the Olympics, but not only the Olympics? And why do so many people find the ideals believable despite the relative paucity of evidence that they are true? So, first of all, when did human rights really begin to matter in international sport? So I became interested in the topic of international sport and human rights as I was writing my second book on US foreign policy and human rights in the 1970s. And one of the first talks I gave on the relationship was already back in 2014. I was invited to South Korea at this large event associated with some bigwigs from the Olympic industry. There were some IOC members there, and there were some South Korean people quite high up in the IOC, in the Olympic hierarchy. And I was quite surprised that, with that exception, when I was able to talk individually to these people, they all expressed confusion and puzzlement about my topic. So they would say things to me like, I saw that you were talking about human rights in the Olympic Games, and I didn't know what you could possibly be talking about, but now I've heard your talk and I can see that you have something to talk about. And their puzzlement actually puzzled me greatly, and I wish now that I had followed up more with them. I was so taken aback that I didn't question it at the time. From my perspective, there had been a lot of talk about human rights and the Olympic Games for a long time. So I think I probably first noticed it maybe around 2006. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch were issuing a lot of reports about human rights abuses in China and talking about how this related to the Olympic Games. And the human rights pressure around the Beijing Games in 2008 was quite significant. And then there was 2014 when, you know, at Sochi, there was an LGBT global outcry about LGBT rights, again, framed in the language of human rights very often. In 2015, when the 2022 Olympics were being awarded, there was again talk about the fact that the only two host cities in the running were in dictatorships. So to me, the relationship seemed very well established. But I think the people in the Olympic industry that I spoke to in 2014 didn't see a relationship the way I did, because, and I'm really just speculating here, I don't have very much evidence, but I would speculate that they, at this conference, there was a lot of talk about ideals, and there was certainly underlying everything that everybody said was an assumption that the Olympics are a force for good. But the way that they thought about it was not in terms of human rights, but in different registers. So they would think about legacy or sustainability or Olympic solidarity, sport for peace, sport as a force for peace. That was what they were comfortable with and familiar with. And this human rights thing, I think, was still something they didn't quite know how to deal with. Now, it is very much now part of what the Olympic industry seeks to do. That is to say, they do want to say that they are very much about promoting human rights. And it's in all of the documents and all of the rhetoric about reform now in the IOC. All these committees, you know, there's an institutionalization. There are all these high profile people, Prince Syed Raad Al Hussein, a former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, has been involved in advising the IOC. It's a huge endeavor now, especially for the IOC, but also for FIFA. Still, from the perspective of a historian of human rights, the fact that this has solidified only very recently, really, I think only in the last couple of years, seems quite surprising, because from the perspective of a human rights historian, we would date the hegemony of human rights as a global moral language, we would date that to the 1990s and the end of the Cold War. So why is it that it takes maybe another 20 years, even maybe more, for the Olympics to sign on to this hegemonic moral language? So I'll run through the history of the relationship very briefly and try to unpack why it is that the IOC might have come to this language of human rights relatively late. And probably what you're thinking is that you're probably thinking about the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games is probably when you would think about the origins of this relationship. So it's certainly true that, as you know, there are boycott efforts in various places. And many of those efforts were framed around the language of human rights. That was not the primary rubric of opposition, however. People talked more about anti-Semitism or combating anti-Semitism, combating discrimination, or the pursuit of peace. So we begin to see human rights associated with the Olympic Games, but it's not a very strong association, and other sorts of languages are more important. Now they do become quite significant, and Umberto has written beautifully about this. They do become significant in the debate over the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow, coming before the invasion of Afghanistan, when the issue before Afghanistan was primarily repression of Soviet dissidents. And it comes at a time Now, I said the 1990s are sort of a crucial decade for human rights. The 1970s are also a crucial decade. They've been called the breakthrough decade for human rights, the decade when human rights breaks out of the narrow confines, being a preserve for international lawyers, and then becomes this language of mass movements. It's the decade when the Soviet dissidents created an oppositional movement that drew very heavily on the language of human rights. They cited the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Andrei Sakharov became a global icon, Solzhenitsyn. Amnesty International won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. It's clearly a lot going on in the area of human rights, and in particular, the Soviet dissident movement is a huge part of what's happening in the global human rights scene. So it's not surprising that there are groups around 77, 78 that are calling for attention to the fact that the Olympics are being hosted by a repressive regime. Although I would note that, as Dmitry Dubrovsky writes in his contribution to the edited volume, The Ideals of Global Sport, he points out that dissidents weren't uniform in calling for a boycott. So Andrei Sakharov, for example, eventually calls for a boycott after Afghanistan, but initially sides with those people who are saying that actually holding the Olympic Games in Moscow will be a good thing. You have international people coming in, you have exchange, you have sort of international ferment, and that's possibly going to lead to reform. And that, of course, that debate crystallizes as the core debate around human rights and the Olympic Games. There are those who say that the host country must meet a certain moral fitness test in order to host the games, before they host the games. And then there are others who say, well, if they're not meeting a moral fitness test yet, it's okay, because the Olympic Games are going to bring pressures that will lead to more openness and lead to more reform. And that's a debate that continues to this day. So in my opinion, the boycott movement in the 1970s, the pressure groups talking about human rights are substantial, but I don't think they get a lot of attention, certainly not relative to what happens in 1993. So in my opinion, what happens in the late 70s is a sort of normal byproduct of this human rights boom of the 70s. And then what we see in 1993, to me, is a huge increase in the level of media attention around the relationship between human rights and the Olympic Games. So what happened in 1993 is that Beijing bid for the Olympic Games. And a lot of people in the human rights movement were offended by this, because it came just a few years after the Tiananmen Square massacre. And it seemed to be offensive that this regime that had just massacred so many of its people would host this global event that would help it whitewash its crimes. And in particular, Human Rights Watch throws itself into a campaign to deny Beijing the hosting rights. It does so largely because of a single person, whose name is Robert Bernstein, and he really makes the decision and then pushes it through. But it becomes one of the organization's top priorities in 1993. They write to corporate sponsors of the Olympics, they write to IOC members, they mount a major press campaign, and a lot of newspaper articles and media attention is given to this issue. And it resonates because of Tiananmen Square, which is still fresh in the memories of many people. And in fact, Human Rights Watch seems to win. So as you know, we don't know why it is that IOC members vote. They vote in secret. We don't know who voted for which city. And they don't explain their votes. So we can't say for sure why it is that Beijing lost by two votes. But we do know that when Samaranch opened the envelope to reveal the winner, he was shocked. He was visibly shocked to see that it was not Beijing, but it was Sydney. And certainly Human Rights Watch at the time and a lot of the media at the time attributed Beijing's very, very close failure to this human rights campaign. Indeed, in China, it provoked a nationalist reaction in which the Americans were accused of trying to stop China's rise through efforts to prevent it from doing things like hosting the Olympic Games. And I'll just mention that the response of the IOC and of the Chinese organizers in 1993 had mostly been to not take this human rights campaign very seriously, and to mostly defend themselves with, as I'm sure you can imagine, the old standby, which is that sport and politics don't mix. Human rights is politics. Please don't talk to us about politics. But when Beijing bids again in 2001, this time for 2008, they are much wiser. Both the Chinese and the IOC are much more savvy about towing the line around human rights. They do a much better job of paying lip service to human rights instead of just dismissing it as irrelevant. So they make various promises about press freedoms, etc. They suggest that the Olympics will bring reforms to China. And then in the years immediately before 2008, there's a real turning point. I think at this point, it becomes impossible for major human rights organizations not to have a policy about the Olympics. So Amnesty International, for example, had said very little in 1993 when Beijing had bid for the Games. And even within Human Rights Watch, it had been a controversial idea to take up the issue of sport. In the years before the Beijing Games, it becomes a standard part of the repertoire of these big human rights organizations and many others to have a position. And I'd like to say that we may not think of this as an obvious thing, but for human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have a lot in common with the IOC. They're both undemocratic, not particularly accountable to anyone. They claim to be idealistic and to do good in the world, but they're also clearly self-interested. And that's not a criticism. It's perfectly natural for organizations to want to grow, to gain more members, to get more press attention. That's true of all organizations. And certainly the human rights organizations, as they began to talk about the Olympics, saw that it was to their advantage to do so. They could get new audiences, new sources of donations, and they hunger for media attention. That's how they do their work, is through media attention. And what gets more media attention than the Olympic Games? So there's definitely a self-interested way that the growth in interest from the human rights side is propelled. And I just want to mention too that their interest is not simply in the Games as sporting events, not in the 16 days of the Olympic Games. They have a very expansive view of what human rights responsibilities the Olympic Games should be undertaking. Countries that engage in widespread torture or political imprisonment, in their view, need to be pressured about those things, even though those things have no direct relationship to sports. Now, I think one of the reasons why the IOC was slow to see that it could have a mutually beneficial relationship with these human rights organizations, which I think it is developing now. It was slow to get to that point in part because and had a very hard time making sense of these big demands. The IOC thinks of itself as organizing a sporting competition. That's a very, very complicated thing to do, as we know. And that's, it's got its hands full doing that. To say that it must also take on whether a government is arresting dissidents seems, it just seems kind of, you know, crazy to the IOC, at least around 2008. And Nicholas McPhailen, who worked for Human Rights Watch in Hong Kong around 2008, said it was incredibly frustrating to deal with the IOC, because the IOC would have one position one day and then another position the next day. It didn't seem to know how to make up its mind about this issue of human rights. And it didn't ever seem, the leadership never seemed to sit down and think about it deeply enough to make a decision about what line it was going to take consistently. So my own theory is that Jacques Roga and the IOC leadership at that time, they just couldn't wrap their heads around the idea that they had any responsibility in relation to those broad, again, not related to sport, human rights issues. And they didn't really understand the climate of opinion globally around human rights. And they also were so deeply convinced that they already are bringing a lot of good to the world, you know, peace and whatever. In my opinion, it took the accession of a new leader, Thomas Bach, in 2013, and his wrestling with the 2014 LGBT rights controversy, along with other pressures on the Olympic Games that I'm sure we all know about. It took that for Bach to sit down and decide that he needed to be serious about human rights. And that's what we see now, is that the IOC is taking human rights very seriously. Whether it's doing anything in reality is a different question, but certainly in rhetoric, it's very much talking the language of human rights. And I would say, really for the first time in Olympic history. So I wanna just say a few words about peace, the other ideal, or one of the ideals that's been associated with international sport, the one that's been associated for the longest time, really since the inception of international sport. The justification has been that you bring people together, athletes compete, the competitions will foster international friendship, mutual understanding, and peace. And I would be very interested to get your views on this, because it puzzles me the extent to which the IOC and other international sports bodies take this claim for granted. And by that I mean that in other situations where there have been claims that something or other is correlated with peace, let's say democracies don't go to war with each other, right? That's a claim. In that case, political scientists and IR specialists have devoted a lot of time to testing that claim. As far as I know, they have not tried to test any relationship between international sport and international peace. So of course there's this subfield of work that's being done on sport and post-conflict reconciliation, but that's a minor piece of the puzzle. This bigger question about peace is largely unstudied. And so I wonder why it is that the rhetoric of peace is largely unchallenged today. Of course, there are critics, right? But I think the dominant the mainstream view is that somehow these international sports competitions do have some kind of beneficial effects in the realm of reducing levels of conflict and increasing mutual understanding. Why is it that we believe that, even when the evidence would seem to suggest that that's not true, given that the 20th century is one of both huge rise in international sport and incredible levels of conflict and war? So let me conclude with some thoughts about the significance of the morality of global sport. And the first is that, to me, I think there's still much more that can be done with the research program that Dietrich Quandt started many years ago, which is to understand international sport as an idealistic internationalism related to other idealistic internationalisms. So the IOC, for example, now has a very interesting and very complicated relationship with Human Rights Watch, which is not entirely conflictual and which brings benefits to both sides. And the IOC has a much longer and deeper relationship with ideas of peaceful internationalism. I think we could, for example, do much more to understand the links between the IOC's idealistic internationalism and the mid-20th century fad for mutual understanding. There are huge numbers of conferences and organizations and publications in the mid-20th century that claim that mutual understanding will happen if we have international exchange. How do the Olympic Games fit into that? In short, the ideals associated with sport deserve more study for the way that they constitute a way of imagining the international and how that way relates to other ways that have so much shaped our international society today. And finally, and rather in contradiction to what I've been saying, I would suggest that the task should not be to debunk Olympic ideals or to show the ways that the Olympics have fallen short of meeting its ideals, but to think of those ideals as political myths in a sociological sense. They're not testably true. They're not claims whose veracity matters if we think of them as myths. Instead, indeed, this is the way they're presented. They're beyond questioning. And I'm very much influenced here by Jessica Reinbold's conception of the Universal Human Rights Program as myth. So she says that universal human rights weren't intended to enumerate rights as much as they were intended to build expectations about how the world should operate. Affective, emotional expectations that draw on social, aesthetic, and religious logics. These constitute what Reinbold calls a dense, evocative narrative designed to generate meaning, solidarity, and order for a particular audience. And in that sense, in the sense that these are myths, I think the internationalist ideals of the Olympics and international sport deserve more attention. Not in the simplistic way that I just did with peace, which is to say, there's no evidence for peace, but in a way that appreciates the fact that what international sport tries to do with its idealism is to shape our vision of what the world should be like. And I'll end with that and very much look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara, for your presentation.